I got thinking about it, and of course, Ken has ongoing administrative duties, so he'll get chances, take chances to speak to all of us throughout the rest of the week. But this is my last shot at you, so you know, hold your applause. But this will be my last chance to say anything, and so I'll just say thank you for being here. This is like probably the best week for me of the year. I don't always remember that from year to year. Then I get here and I remember that it is. It's a blessing to me in so many ways. I appreciate just you guys. Everybody know who the Blue Angels are? The Navy's flight demonstration team. I served with a couple of those guys different places while I was in the Navy, and I learned this about them. They have this tradition that after every day practice or after every air show they do, they always come in and do, in aviation, we always do what's called a debrief. The point is, you've spent the taxpayers' money and your time. You might as well learn all you can from what you just went out and did, right? So in that debrief, in the Blue Angels, the boss, what they call the commanding officer of the squadron, he starts the debrief. But then the first time he addresses you or you have a point to make, the first thing you have to say every day is, glad to be here, boss. Because they want you to recognize what a privilege it is, what honor it is, and what all goes into allowing you to do that thing you do that you love to do. So every time Ken says something about next year or whatever, I'm just, my thought is, I'm glad to be here, boss. Just happy to be part of this. I feel like I'm stealing every year. I get so much out of the time I spend listening to the other instructors. At least I learn some stuff from my preparation, whether anybody else does or not, that's bonus. And then just being with all of you. It's encouraging to know there's folks that want to be here as well, that'll drive, spend the time, take the time off from work and the things you do to be here. So it's been a great week for me again. I'm glad to see so many of you, and hopefully, Lord willing, we'll do this again next year. But the final installment we're going to look at this week in our block we've called Uncertain Sounds is playing the Pharisee card. So what do you think I'm getting at here? Huh? Okay. You guys familiar with the term playing the race card? What does race card mean in our current culture and context?
It means no matter what it is, they're
going to play the race. Yes. Or if you disagree with someone, even if it's over their ideas, but they're of a different race, or this thing is going crazy now, gender, whatever, they'll be oversimplified. Say, well, you're just disagreeing with me because of this, and then you'll be labeled as a racist. That sort of thing. You're all familiar with the idea, and again, that it's going beyond just race now, that because of identity politics that we talked about earlier today, that sort of thing. So you're familiar with this concept, and you know that it's when that happens, when somebody is labeled a racist in a situation like this, usually it's done for the purpose of, not because it's even a serious charge, really, but it's to discredit the person so that it discredits whatever argument they're making. And at that moment, you know, the issue or the discussion changes from being about the subject to an attack, an ad hominem attack on the other person. But the thing about that is even if you're in that moment, you're making the argument against someone and that's how they respond to you, is like playing that card, that's still not pleasant, is it? I mean, nobody wants to be accused of being a racist or labeled as a racist, right? So you don't want that to happen. Nobody would desire that or like that. But then an outcome of that is because of fear of being labeled a racist, some folks have let that prevent them from saying true things, right? You don't think that tactic exists for a reason, right? To keep the other side in any given discussion from making their argument, making their points, making their case. And so folks have let fear of being labeled stop them from saying true things. Well, I would suggest to you that I think most of us, raise your hand if you'd like to be called a Pharisee. So I think it's possible then that there's a chance that we have or could allow the fear of being labeled a Pharisee keep us from not just saying true things, but from speaking the truth. And so I think we need to talk about that a little bit, and that's what we're going to do here in our last session. Anybody ever been called a Pharisee? Okay, a few hands up. If not, when you have some discussions, even if you're not personally called a Pharisee, you might be told your argumentation sounds like the Pharisees or something along those lines. It's possible. But I will tell you this. Like I said, we can't let fear of being called a Pharisee keep us from speaking the truth. But I'll give you some ways if you want to avoid ever even running the risk of being called a Pharisee. If you never want that to happen to you, all you have to do is just never publicly defend biblical teachings and practices of the church. Just make sure you're not willing to publicly point out false teaching or false practices in the church today, and you'll probably be fine. See, the connection between today's subject and kind of what we've been talking about like this is I would say it like this. Hey, going forward now, if you never push back on the notion of a gospel doctrine distinction, if you don't determine to preach what God's Word says instead of what you think it means, or if you quit insisting on holding fast to the pattern of sound words, you'll probably be fine. You'll probably never be labeled a Pharisee. But we're going to talk today about when folks play the Pharisee card. Now, here's the class participation part. Because I'm working on, I think I really need some sort of catchy subtitle for this, you know. So the title is Playing the Pharisee Card. And I've been racking my brain on what would be a good subtitle for it. So far, the best I have is When They Love You Enough to Use Ad Hominem Attacks. But that doesn't really flow off the tongue. So if you have some suggestions that you can think of to help me name this, then I'll work on those. Everybody knows what ad hominem attack is? Yeah, so that's a fancy way. When you see it play out, usually just resorting to name calling or labeling, and you get off the issue that was the issue by attacking the person, calling them names. So that's what we're talking about there. So let's go. If you're not familiar with the concept, generally, here's what it is. In religious context, modern-day Pharisees are those who are perceived to emphasize strict adherence to religious rules and traditions while neglecting the core values and principles of their faith. Okay? Furthermore, they are seen as legalistic, focusing on outward compliance with regulations rather than inner transformation and genuine faith. And then finally, essentially, they are seen as hypocritical individuals who prioritize outward appearances of righteousness over genuine love and compassion. So if you had in your mind what I think people would accuse someone, or why would they label someone to be a modern-day Pharisee, does that language resonate with you? Yep, yeah, that's kind of what I was expecting to see, what you would think. Any thoughts or comments or observations about those three bullets there? Yes, sir?
The Bible is true and the Word of God. It is the only thing on that list that's objective.
I think that's right. Yes, sir?
Just like the rest of the stuff that we're looking at, it's false dichotomy.
Ah, thank you. You get a gold star. Because it struck me as I looked at these things. That's exactly right. If you read these carefully, you'll see they're full of false dichotomies, or what you might call the either-or fallacy. And we talked about this already, I mean, a couple times this week. And here's what the point I'm making. If you read that first bullet again, if you read that, the assumption is that you can't be concerned about strict adherence to religious rules and still have or try to practice the core values or principle of your faith. That one almost ends up with you neglecting the other. That's kind of baked into the thing. Or the second bullet there is that if you do try to get your outward compliance correctly, then you must not be, or you must be doing that more than you're trying to be transformed inwardly, or make sure that your works are motivated for the right reason. Or if you are worried about your outward appearance at all, then you probably don't have genuine love and compassion. Do you see how, even if it's subtle, there's this either-or component, this false dichotomy to all of those charges? Does anybody else see that? This kind of baked in? And so this is why I think you got to listen carefully and respond carefully, and make sure before you start responding first, don't concede to these either-ors. And point out the fact that you know, we live in a world where mostly both-and is a possibility. That I can both be genuinely trying to be transformed. And you know what? If I am genuinely trying to be transformed, will I try to get my outward actions to line with that? I will. So there's no really either or here, but you'll see that sort of, I think, logical fallacy come up pretty regularly in a conversation like this. But as I was digging around on the interwebs, trying to find out what people say about this subject, I came across this quotation I found very interesting. Anybody familiar with xchurchofchrist.com? Aha, that's a trick. No, I'm kidding. There's some interesting reading on there sometimes, but I found this little nugget. There are many wonderful churches of Christ. However, there are about 20% that bear a marked similarity to the Pharisees. What, any thoughts on that, a response to that observation? I'm glad you asked. So you'd like to do a little investigation. Where did I get that number? And so he fleshes that out a little bit for us. Here's what he was talking about. I think this is interesting. So 20% of churches of Christ still try to minimize sin and maximize our own ability to measure up to God's holiness. Some preachers in the churches of Christ affirm that Jesus paid the price for our sins, but deny that Jesus traded places with us on the cross. They deny that Jesus' righteousness is credited to us when we are baptized into Christ. Their gratefulness for God's forgiveness is far less than those who teach that we are very sinful. Their power to conquer sin seems to rest in themselves rather than in the powerful grace of Christ's sacrifice. I know in my life it was not until I realized that all of my sins, past, present, and future, had already been paid for that I became joyful enough to begin conquering the sins in my life. So that first paragraph kind of explains some of the things that led to this estimation of 20% based on things that are taught from his perspective in churches of Christ. Is there anything about that summation or his explanation of how he got to that figure that anyone finds interesting? Yes, sir. Well, maybe just a hint. About 66%. Any? Yeah, so there's the problem with this kind of thing cuts a couple ways. But let's look at them just for this, you know, becoming careful readers. So what you would see there, if so, basically what he's saying, here's how I want to handle this. I've decided the technique on these. Who here still remembers Jeff Foxworthy? You know that is, you might be a redneck if. Okay, so here's, you might be a modern-day Pharisee if, is how we're going to go through this quote there, okay? So according to this guy, and based on this one, you might be a modern-day Pharisee if you ever preach against human inability. If you think about it, he's saying the problem that these Pharisees, they talk about our own inability to measure up to God's holiness. So he has a problem with that. According to this guy and others, I'm sure you might be a modern-day Pharisee if. And then this one, you read that Jesus traded places with us on the cross. And I'm for a split second, I'm thinking, I wonder what he means by that. But then I kept reading, and the very next phrase he says that Jesus' righteousness is credited to us. And I realized, oh, that's imputation number 2 and number 3 in the classic Calvinist triple imputation. So once you see, if you don't know what that is, I'll perform it. It's not like a triple Lindy or anything like that. But you see there, everything except original sin has really been accepted by a lot of folks, and that's something he's talking about there. But that's what those things are. And then there's one more you noticed in there that gives you a little concern. Yeah, so there, if you might be a Pharisee if you preach against continual cleansing. So in other words, and this is one website, one place to talk about it, but his point is saying, hey, these churches of Christ are Pharisees. Well, why are they Pharisees? Well, because of reasons like this. So the point here I would say is, after I looked at that, I found it interesting. But then, like a Marshall or two, I'm a little scared that only 20% of us would hit that, right? How frightening is it if this guy's even close to right, and in 80% of our pulpits, these things are being found or being preached? So anyway, there's some this, so that you know this conversation is happening, and this idea of Pharisee or being Pharisees then comes up when you're perceived to be strict against doctrinal errors like these, at least from this guy's perspective and those who read after him. But I kept looking because I found it interesting. You may not be able to read this from where you're sitting, but this is from a Reddit discussion going on, and the headline obviously is, anyone else consider Seal Seers to be modern-day Pharisees? And then he starts this chat. I'll just read you the comments. He says, like, it's like, what the hey, man? There were times when Jesus dismissed the overly legalistic Pharisees by quoting the Scriptures with reasonable arguments. I wonder, despite having read the Bible so much, how come the Seal Seers can't see the irony? Why can't they see that they are essentially neo-Pharisees? Can anything be done to help someone snap out of it? So he asked this question, hey, anybody else see this problem? And then he thinks he describes it. I love the first response. It's yes. Absolutely, no doubt in my mind, at the very least, some congregations are. And then my favorite part, my mother-in-law is. So there you go. Thanksgiving will be fun there this year. I'm sure that's great. But you keep reading. Oh, yeah, listen to this. Preacher gave a full Sunday sermon on the Pharisees, how to recognize one, how to avoid being like them. I left church that day completely horrified, realizing the entire COC was full of Pharisees. I had a real, are we the bad guys moment. Looking back, that may have been my first moment of deconstruction, questioning what I had been taught instead of blindly accepting it. And then the final comment there, I'm going to assume it was one of those things when everybody told him it was a good sermon and then it changed nothing. So that's a sample of a conversation there, and you get the gist of kind of the things that are being talked about. But just so you know, this isn't a Church of Christ exclusive problem. As you guys are observant within the entire religious world, any rules are too much now for folks. So within every discipline, every denomination, every group, they're having some of these same conversations because they have some old curmudgeons among them who actually want to have some rules, and that's just too much for folks. So you can go out and find a lot wider conversations about modern-day Pharisees. What are the 10 things Pharisees say? What does a modern Pharisee look like? Modern-day Pharisees and Sadducees, that sort of thing. So this discussion happens within a broader context. But I'm going to just kind of let that serve as an introduction. Then this is... You're sharing an important historical moment for me and my personal development. Here's my first use of AI. So when I start Googling and doing some research and stuff, now you get the auto AI-generated search results. So I thought, well, that's a good general idea of what must be out there in writ large on about this problem of modern-day Phariseeism. So I'm going to work through those. I'm going to click them off. We'll read the definitions. And if you have a question, a comment, or an observation, just feel free to include it. But if you go and talk about, well, why does somebody get called a modern-day Pharisee or who are the modern-day Pharisees, then things like this start popping up. Well, they're legalistic. They're overly focused on adhering to rules and regulations, often to the point of ignoring the spirit and intent behind them. So once again, we've kind of talked about this, but you see that kind of laced in there is this assumption that they're doing one thing at the expense of doing something else. It's always the either or, neither. Not even contemplating that someone could genuinely be trying to do both and. But that's always seems to be part of it. This one, they're hypocritical. They may outwardly appear righteous while engaging in actions or harboring attitudes that contradict their professed beliefs. I'll say this about that. That's actually a legitimate problem, isn't it? I mean, you can actually be a hypocrite. None of us want to make it outward show of righteousness, but have attitudes or act in ways that are contrary to what we profess to believe. So that's, a valid, at least concern there, however you categorize it or label it. Self-righteous. They tend to judge and condemn others for not following the same strict rules or traditions while overlooking their own shortcomings. Could that be a legitimate observation and concern? But again, there's nuance to be teased out in there. Where do those rules and traditions come from? Are they of our own origin we're talking about? Are they ones God's given us? Which then following them strictly would be the right way to do it. And whatever you're doing about that first phrase, if you're overlooking your own shortcomings, then you're not being or trying to be who you need to be anyway. So there were more egotistical. They seek to be seen as righteous and are more concerned with their own standing in the community than with the needs of others. What's that? That's right. That can be true. If it is, that's a reason for concern. Blind guides. They are seen as leading others astray by placing undue emphasis on rules and rituals rather than genuine faith and compassion. So again, if that ended up being the case for someone, that would be a problem. But you see the baked in either or. That if you're concerned, you know, if you read that, what you're really kind of being told is if you're concerned about the rules, you're not concerned about this. Or at least, you know, we need to make sure we understand that it's possible. It is possible to place an emphasis on being obedient and still that be a product of genuine faith and driven by compassion and manifest compassion. So there's the disparity that is implied in some of these charges. We don't need to concede that if we're having these discussions. Focus on tradition. They prioritize traditions passed down through generations over the scriptures and the core message of their faith. I think most of us would see that as a problem, right? In a challenge, and we would have to at least be mindful of that. Then I think the last page here, ignoring the spirit of the law. Heard something about that recently, I think. They may focus on the literal interpretation of rules while neglecting the underlying principles and purposes of those laws. Condemning and accusatory. So now it's kind of more about personality. And we've even, I think Rick's made a couple comments this week. It's important, in every case, it's important how we carry ourselves and in the manner with which we address others, we talk to others, we even confront others, like Ken mentioned in his talk today, if that need be. But the assumption here is they often judge and accuse others who don't conform to their rigid standards, even if those others are genuinely struggling. And they're blind to their own sins. They're often blind to their own hypocrisies, shortcomings, while focusing on the mistakes of others. Is there anything on that list that shocked or surprised you, or anything you expected to see that's not there? Or any thoughts generally now that we've seen that whole list that, again, this is getting talked about enough among enough people that this is kind of what was generated by looking across the internet and seeing what people are saying? It's almost impossible that, because if you write it down, then it becomes a little letter. See? It's almost impossible, isn't it? So how would one communicate the Spirit? So, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Yeah. Yes, sir.
There's a kernel of truth in most of those, which is the big concern. There may be people that are guilty legitimately of many of these things.
Yeah.
And the label would be proper, even though maybe we shouldn't use it.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
You know, the issue.
It's always an issue to maybe be called a legalist. I was listening to John MacArthur, and he was debating something the great New Testament scholar and theologian Donald J.
Well, was it from 2 Corinthians? Where did he find? Okay.
He said, "I always pray for our country, and I pray to be good, because if I'm good, I go to heaven." John MacArthur was carrying on about that, and it is an oversimplification. He was like, "That's the prime heresy. That there's anything you could do to go to heaven." And it's like, what book of the Bible? It's not written with the intent of inspiring covenant faithfulness within us. Like, we do want to be people of the law of Christ.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
A large problem with the modern argument against Pharisee, a modern-day Pharisee, is it's a lot. It's not a kernel. It's a lot of truth. But it's just subjective enough to where I can apply it to any opinion I have. Jesus fought against the Pharisees. But when he fought against the Pharisees, he did not fight with opinion. He said, "Thus says the Lord."
Yeah.
This is exactly what God said. And so one might say that Jesus fights the error of the Pharisee with a legalistic argument. It says, no, you forgot the law.
Yeah.
It's not that you adhered to the law too strictly. It's that you forgot what the law was.
Yeah.
And you need to adhere to the actual law more strictly.
That's right. And we're going to get to some of that in a second. Yes, sir.
I think this also ties very much into what Stephen's been talking about and like assuming the motivations of people and assuming being critical in your assumptions, because the assumption is that if you are concerned about doing what God says, then you must be all of these other things. You must be a hypocrite because there's no way you're actually doing those things.
Yeah, and it also, I think, a modern thing you see is that really, you guys, the inability to have a real reasoned argument, because there's not a willingness to deal with objective truth and be proven wrong and change your mind. When's the last time you saw, other than, you know, in Facebook comment sections, when's the last time you saw somebody go, oh, that's a good point, I'm going to change my view on this? And it just doesn't happen, and so then it's easier to make it the ad hominem attack of someone who expresses opinion different than yours.
Elevating tradition to the same level of scripture as potential authority. I don't think that was specifically stated. A couple of things.
Real close to it, yeah. Yeah, but let me at this point say, and I wanted to say this. I'm not sure right here where I plan to, but if I say it twice, it won't hurt anything. But here's what I want us to do now before we click on the next slide is, one of the errors we make sometimes is somebody comes up with a terrible answer, so we just assume they must have asked bad questions, right? And so we ignore any benefit that could be. So what I would say is, as we went through here, you guys picked out some kernels of truth or some things that possibly we could do. And I think that's the thing is, we ought to always be willing to examine a critique, because there might be something in there that's legitimate that we could respond to, or we could see in ourselves that we could improve or try to avoid the full-grown problems that are pretty apparent maybe here. But so my point would be, don't ever dismiss the idea if you're just being accused of being Pharisee. Listen to it. But when you evaluate it, as Craig pointed out, evaluate it not against what they think a modern-day Pharisee is. Evaluate it against the idea of what Jesus said to say and how he interacted with the Pharisees. So anyway, up to this point, we've really kind of just talked about the idea, talked about how it's out there, and we've looked at what people most on the outside have to say about it or what their definitions are. And then while I was looking at this, where I got to by the time I finished all that was, then I combined that with the times and places I've heard our brethren label other members of our fellowship as Pharisees. And I thought, well, I'll tell you what I thought was captured very well in a quote from Brother John Gibson. He says, I frequently hear and read of religious people today being referred to as Pharisees, but I don't believe the word means what many of those who used to think it means, who use it, think it means. So I know you're thinking that sounds a lot like Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride, right? But I think John's on to something there. You keep using that word, but I'm not sure that you know what that word means, and I think he's right about that, or potentially right about that. So let's talk about then, kind of getting through that idea, that this might happen. You might get labeled a Pharisee. No one wants to be called a Pharisee. We just looked at a pretty long list of some pretty negative things that conveys in the mind of the one using that label on you. But let's see what Jesus condemned the Pharisees for. We're just going to kind of really distill it down to the things that was actually talked about. And again, we can probably move pretty quickly because none of these are going to be new to this audience. And you know that Jesus condemned the Pharisees for self-righteousness, right? So that's a legitimate observation if someone is self-righteous. In Luke chapter 18, he also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. And I love how, you know, that's the introduction, and then he goes into that story that demonstrates that. Two men went up to the temple to pray, and one a Pharisee and the other the tax collector, and you know the rest of that story. I'm thankful I'm not like him, and a listing of the reasons why I'm righteous. So this idea of treating others with contempt, self-righteousness, that's a legitimate problem. That's something we would want to avoid. Jesus condemned the Pharisees for that, and that would condemn us as well. And I think that could be a problem. I think it's ironic. We're in early July. Seems to me that maybe every year in June, this rears its head a little bit during Pride Month, you know, because sometimes I'll see Christians who will, you know, almost like there's one sin they come out and publicly condemn all year long. That's going to be it, a whole month of that. But then also, if just many Christians go, I'm so thankful I don't really condemn homosexuality during the month of June. And they'll start running down their brethren. So you see, like, hey, both sides, you know, why don't you quit beating yourselves on the chest and just going back and try to be right yourself. But anyway, I think we recognize that self-righteousness, if we display self-righteousness, that's a problem. And that's one of the things that Jesus condemned the Pharisees for. Or you may remember from Matthew 9 that Jesus reclined at the table and the tax collectors and sinners, and he was dining with them, and the Pharisees saw this. They said to his disciples, why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and sinners? So obviously they were worried about who he was socializing with because they considered themselves above the tax collectors and the sinners. They were self-righteous about those kind of things. And, you know, this one I think is important in this passage here to remember that, because sometimes this passage gets flipped around. See, well, Jesus ate with the sinners. You've heard it used that way, right? But the way I try to explain that to people says, yeah, but Jesus never missed the point. It was a doctor-patient relationship, right? Jesus was there, but he never just became another inmate in the asylum. He always knew it was as a doctor-patient relationship that he was eating there with sinners, and he had a reason for being there. Yes. Yeah, that's how this passage is misused, and we want to miss that. But you see the Pharisees' perspective, that they thought they were righteous in condemning Jesus for being with those people. And Jesus did condemn the Pharisees for elevating man-made traditions, right? And we've talked about that. And the examples here from the Gospels, you know, that was both of these are instances around the hand washing. Well, you know, why do your disciples not follow the tradition of the elders? And Jesus answered them, and why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? Or the way Mark words it is, you leave the commandment of God to hold to the tradition of men. So these Pharisees were, as was mentioned, had this tradition they had come up with that they were elevating above the Word of God, above God's traditions, the commandment of God there. And they had elevated their own teaching, their own ordinances, their own commands above that. And that, so we have to recognize that would be a problem if we found ourselves in a situation of doing that, that we don't allow a man-made tradition, one of our traditions, to take on the weight of a commandment of God. Have you ever been in a situation where someone made that accusation, or have you ever been in an example of where you think you've maybe seen that happen? Maybe we got close with a letter of membership. I don't know what would happen if you couldn't get yours. I don't know how that would happen. You ever heard anybody say, well, I know you guys think you got to have two songs prayer, Lord's Supper, you know, like something as simple as that. You guys think it's got to be just like this, just like that. And so the accusation is made sometimes that we've taken traditions and elevated them to as if they were law. We avoid that at Eastside by just telling the song leader, hey, you're the song leader. You set it up the order you want to. We pick, tell them when to have the prayer, when to have the Lord's Supper, how many songs to sing, that sort of thing. But that's actually a charge that I've heard people make. You've made that into a tradition. You make that as if it's you're inflexible. It has to be just this way. And I'm sure there are others and more. But
how many of us have visited another congregation for the first time and they do something different than the way we're used to it? Not necessarily wrong, but how did it make us feel?
Yeah, uncomfortable and uncomfortable. Yeah.
And you have to go back in your mind and say, was it wrong or was I wrong?
Yeah, and I was having a conversation with somebody earlier this week and talking about one benefit of being in the military was at a very young age moving to places all over this country and seeing things done, at least even just a little bit different than I was used to in South Central Kentucky. And it forced me at a relatively young age to have that inner dialogue. Hey, wait. Does this make me uncomfortable because it's wrong or just because I haven't seen it before? Or just because I'm uncomfortable with it or just because it's not exactly how we did it? And I think that was a valuable thing to have to think through some of those things.
This country, the congregation churches, well, I guess all around the world, kind of tasted this a little bit during COVID. What decisions other congregations, the elders of other congregations are making to keep their people safe, or what's in the best interest of them. I've heard a lot of people speak as if it was doctrine that you're not allowed to use the little pods for the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
You better pass the plate, don't leave it in the back for people so not everybody touches it. There's a lot of traditions that were tested.
And I'll just say this about that. So that's enough discussion to realize that, you know, we need to be concerned to make sure that we don't elevate our man-made traditions to the level of above or being even on par with a divine commandment and instruction. So don't do that, because Jesus did condemn the Pharisees for doing that. He also condemned them for focusing on externals. That'd be a way to, I think, summarize some of the language. You remember in Matthew 15, he said, "For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adultery, sexual morality, theft, false witness, and slanders. They are what defile a person, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a person." So Jesus' point there is, you know, you're so worried about the hand washing before you eat it, but what defiles you is what comes out of your heart. And so you think even the connections made in the Sermon on the Mount between those outer conducts that the Pharisees were concerned about regulating, and Jesus getting to the heart of it, literally. That's problems in the heart. You know, murder starts with anger. Adultery starts with lust, and how he talked about things in the Sermon on the Mount. But there was this critique of them being exclusively almost focused on externals. You see that comes up in Matthew. Of course, a lot of material in Matthew 23 for this discussion. But that comes up there where you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but the inside, you're full of greed and self-indulgence. For you're like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all kind of uncleanness. And the language there specifically is about the idea of getting the external things, the visible things, stressing those at the expense of not cleaning the inside, not being transformed, not being changed, not being motivated by the right things, not doing things to be seen, I think, might even be the other way to think about this. It really backs into just pure hypocrisy. But thoughts, questions, comments, anything on this idea of the focus on the externals?
Yeah, we're putting out the false dichotomy in some of the accusations, but here Jesus knew their hearts, so it wasn't an assumption or presumption.
Yeah, and that's the point. That kind of blends what Craig said while going. The point is, when Jesus says it, it's not a false dichotomy, because he can see the inside, right? He knows what's in man, and kind of thing. But it still shows us really the core or the substance of what his problem with the Pharisees was. It was true hypocrisy or true focus on the externals. And he knew, you know, we can make the accusation, you're so focused on the external, you're not, but I don't really know what you're doing in your heart. But Jesus did, and that was a distinction between him and us. And then, you know, Matthew 23, obviously, you roll maybe a couple of things up under this. If you really struggle with self-righteousness and you struggle with a self-righteousness based on external things, then hypocrisy is kind of a natural flow from that, right? Because I'm going to try to make you see external things that you will judge me the way I want you to judge me instead of what may be true. So hypocrisy, obviously, Matthew 23 talks about the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you, observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works, for they say and they don't do. And you guys, again, are familiar with this passage. He's talking about the difference between someone who says the right things but doesn't do it, talks the talk, doesn't walk the walk, bind on others things they're unwilling to do themselves. So hypocrisy is a problem. And Jesus condemned the Pharisees for hypocrisy. And again, we could read the whole of Matthew 23. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut down the kingdom of heaven in people's faces, for you neither enter yourself nor allow those who would go in to enter." Or even down to verses 20-24, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others, you blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel." And of course, this passage gets, I think, misused in maybe a couple different ways, and we've talked about one of them already. You know, some folks say the teaching here, see, those little things aren't important. Jesus says, no, these you should have done. And then also, sometimes you're even accused, well, you're straining at gnats. Okay, but I want you to see what Jesus said here, because the problem isn't that you're straining the gnat. Who wants to drink gnats? So the problem isn't straining a gnat. The problem is you're swallowing a camel. That's what's ridiculous, is swallowing a camel. So this isn't anti-gnat straining. This is anti-camel swallowing. And that gets turned around, I think, when people want to use this for their own purposes. So there you have on hypocrisy. And then finally, literally, I'm not saying, I may have missed a couple, but Jesus charged the Pharisees with the love of money, right? He blatantly, almost as an aside there in Luke 16, now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things and they derided him. So there is legitimate inspired record of the things Jesus condemned the Pharisees for, and that's them. Thoughts, questions, comments?
Think about the focus on the external. That's a very subjective thing. Like, at what point have we focused too much on external? It's not that we shouldn't focus on it at all.
Right.
But I do think the thing that I try to challenge myself with is not only to speak where the Bible speaks, but to emphasize what the Bible emphasizes. And I think that should be our goal.
Yeah. I think the natural problem is, that's for us, that's probably best left in the realm of personal inventory. Because I can't see your inside. So if I get too worried about telling you you're stressing externals too much, I'm making assumptions about what's going on in your heart. Because all I can see is the external, right? So in my mind, that's why Jesus can say that, because he knows what's in the heart of a man. But a lot of times we're tempted to say that because we're tempted, and as Stephen mentioned about it, sometimes we've got to be careful not to assign motives and just examine the objective piece, what they're teaching or what their doctrine. Sometimes we're tempted to look at an external and make an assumption about it. This week I was talking to somebody who said they knew someone who really had a problem with folks dressing up for worship service. You're wearing a coat and a tie, you're self-righteous. Well, I mean, maybe it's a humble person who his understanding of giving God his best means going and putting on the best suit of clothes he has on Sunday morning as he goes into God's presence. So I think we need to always make that allowance for the things Jesus could do that we can't do. Yes, sir.
While we are trying to emphasize what the Bible emphasizes, that we also acknowledge that emphasis is going to be somewhat demanded by circumstances. In other words, if I'm dealing with an issue, I am going to need to emphasize that more in my own study, and
yes,
even in my own teaching. And so people are going to say, you're overemphasizing. Well, maybe that's because I'm having to emphasize that. I was talking the other day about people saying, we didn't even used to have conversations about, there were sermons about what a woman was, we didn't have to.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Apparently we have to have sermons like that now.
Yeah.
So we may have to emphasize something more than the Bible emphasizes it because our culture is needing it.
Yeah, and I will tell you a historically relevant event that's had fallout among us was, it doesn't shock me for people 5 or 10 years older than me to say, I sure heard a lot of sermons about authority when I was growing up. Well, what had just happened and what was going on among our fellowship in the 1960s? A complete split of churches over the issue of authority, right? So in that instance, in those circumstances, when somebody's bleeding, you say, well, no, this week I plan to cover nutrition. No, you go over and stop the bleeding, right? I mean, so you have to talk about some things because of the circumstances that are forced upon you. So in that instance, yeah, it might be like, we sure are talking about this a lot. There have been cyclic things that come through, and that ends to be focus, but sometimes there's a reason for that in a greater context. Yes, sir.
It's also important to note that Jesus' condemnation of the Pharisees for their hypocrisy did not excuse the people that were listening to them from keeping the law.
Yeah.
That seems to be the way the argument is used. You're a Pharisee, so I'm just going to go do what I want today.
Yeah, and so if we went back a slide, that passage right there, usually when this comes up, about the weightier matters, the whole reason for bringing this up is because someone doesn't want to do the tithing of the spices. And Jesus never dismisses that. So, last shot, anything else about what Jesus actually did say to the Pharisees?
The interaction with the Pharisees, what was their reaction to what Jesus said? Tomorrow, praise the God, we need to have extreme ownership. If these things are hurled at us, the very fact that we examine them and enough to them and take ownership of them tells us that that will stop us from being criticized.
then that's not true about us if we're willing to listen, learn, fix. Gail.
Still unworthy servants that you're supposed to do those things, but you're unworthy, you need the mercy.
That's a good point. But that's right, because critical to all those issues you put all together, humility would solve about all of them, wouldn't it? Even if I was given to those who are concerned about outward appearance, if I was humble enough, I should be honest about my outward appearance. I wouldn't be trying to fool people and that sort of thing. So that is, now I want you to think about what Jesus actually said to the Pharisees, and then take a 4-minute break, and then we'll pick up here with the things Jesus never condemned about the Pharisees.
I was just going to mention it. The Pharisees are unteachable. They refuse to be taught.
I'm going to hit the pause button. Sorry.
You're good. But I mean, that's one of the things I see. That goes to the blind guides. They refused to be taught.
Yeah, that'll come up. I wrestle with how I worded something in here, because grand scheme of things, there's the things we can say observationally of the Pharisees.
Yeah.
But aren't things that are specific charges Jesus leveled about them. So I was kind of trying to, in that tension, trying to decide on a couple things. Yes, sir.
I was kind of making a joke with Jake, but I think there's some truth to it, that whenever you preach a sermon like this, that it's almost considered gaslighting. You're just trying to avoid being the reality of the fact that you're a Pharisee.
Well, maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit. I'm trying to take the sting out of the accusation if you know it's false. That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. But you're probably right, which is a very postmodern term, right? We didn't say gaslighting 15 years ago, 10 years ago.
Marshall has played with the idea. Well, I preached a sermon, and I wanted to title it What the Pharisees Got Right.
Yeah.
Because I want, in our congregation, I want to emphasize the point to our young people especially is, hey, Matthew 23:23, them wanting to do the whole will of God was not the problem.
I think it's interesting to go back a little bit. What's the relationship between them and Hasidim, and who were their follower, the Maccabees? And for all the problems they had, keeping Hellenization at bay helped preserve, that remnant down to the point where Jesus came. It's a mixed bag, but it's like you can't ever tell people that Hitler made the trains run on time, right? You just can't say anything good about certain people.